Yeah. In theory, indeed, in theory, offering malus incentives is more effective than offering bonus incentives. So let's examine the theoretical argument. The theoretical argument for the higher efficiency of malus incentive systems as opposed to bonus incentive systems, the crux of this argument has to do with the notion of loss aversion. So not only are we risk averse, we're also loss averse. Okay? So the loss aversion implies that your disutility of losing part of your pay that you have already mentally appropriated will be greater than the disutility of losing the same amount that you mentally account for as the bonus that is conditional on your future performance. So that's basically the argument there, right? So if you're thinking about an extra 100 euros that you will receive if you deliver a certain performance outcome, then, you know, when you think about whether to react to this incentive or ignore it, you compare the expected marginal product of this 100 euros extra with the marginal cost of effort that is required of you to achieve this. And if the marginal benefit exceeds the marginal cost, you go for it. If not, you don't go for it, right? So, okay. And given the distribution of noise and the distribution of the costs of effort, you can calculate analytically the probability with which you will find it worth investing your effort, right? Okay, now, consider exactly the same situation, except that this 100 euros has already been given to you, so you already sort of counted this money towards your wage. Now, if you do not deliver the required performance outcome, then this 100 euros will be taken out of your wage. So what is the marginal benefit of effort in this case? The marginal benefit of effort is the minus this utility of losing the 100 euros of your wage. The marginal cost stays the same. Now, the prospect theory and the notion of loss aversion imply that the utility of gaining extra 100 euros is less than the marginal utility or than minus the marginal disutility of losing 100 euros. You see what I mean? And therefore, with the marginal benefit of effort being higher in the malus case, the chance that you will increase effort and the amount of effort that you will spend chasing after this bonus will both be higher in the case of malus than in the case of bonus. Okay? So that's the theoretical argument. Let's look at the empirical side. On the empirical side of things, there is actually a lot of psychological literature looking at things like endowment effect, for instance. But that's not direct. That's not direct. The most direct evidence for the malus effect to operate is given by the paper of Hossein and List that we studied as part of this course, when workers were given rewards-based incentives as well as punishment-based incentives. And they found that there was a small but statistically significant difference in performance in response to punishment-based system as opposed to rewards-based system. So people basically work harder when there's punishment than when there's reward. Notice, however, that this effect only exists for teams. And we had a seminar last week on topics in economics of incentives. Some of you have attended this seminar. And there we discussed why this effect was to be seen in teams and not among the individual workers. So, but we're not going to repeat this discussion today. We're just going to say that the empirical evidence, the direct empirical evidence for the importance of loss aversion considerations in the workplace when it comes to incentives is fragile, is limited. Okay? So that the reason number one is that, you know, not a lot of people are totally sure that malus-based incentives will actually work better than bonus-based incentives. So it's not the stuff that they teach in business schools. It's not among the set of common practices of compensation benefits management, at least not yet. So, reason number two, it's much harder to practice malus-based incentives than bonus-based incentives. It's not impossible. You know, my incentives are malus-based. My personal incentives are based on malus rather than bonus. So you do have malus-based incentives practice, but it's hard to practice them. And these incentives may or may not be compatible with the regulation, with the legislation, and there is always a risk that people will try to sue you, especially if there is no hard, verifiable, quantitatively, objectively estimable performance outcomes on which you condition such incentives. So consider, for example, in a malus-based incentive scheme where whether or not you get a malus depends on the subjective performance evaluation by your boss, for example, right? So this is a very crazy incentive scheme. Don't even think about doing it in practice if you're in a position to do it in practice, because the boss will have a direct incentive to say you have failed your performance evaluation, and the worker will anticipate this and will not exceed, will not excel in their performance, right? So there is a danger of hold up, there is a danger of ex post negotiation. So there's a lot of administrative issues that one has to deal with when practicing malus-based incentives. And the third reason is that firms in practice are very careful about maintaining a good psychological climate in the workplace, right? So this is not part of formal models. We don't study it as part of the equation when we think about optimal design of incentive schemes. But in reality, you don't want to make decisions that will result in a deterioration of employee attitudes, perceptions, feelings, etc. Now, if you have a person not meeting performance requirements and not receiving the bonus that they've already appropriated, yes, they would have worked harder, maybe theoretically trying to maintain the level of salary that they've agreed upon, but the disappointment, the chagrin that workers will have will be also higher than when they don't win a bonus, framed as a bonus rather than malus. And therefore, we know, for example, one of the hard facts emerging from a large body of literature is that when people are not satisfied with their wages, what they do, they quit. It's, you don't need to have a master in economics to understand this, but it's actually quantitatively true. So people quit when they're not happy with wages. You would say, oh, okay, never mind. Let's get the selection effect in operation. And the selection effect to operate, we do need quits, right? So there's nothing wrong with quits. However, this is a naive view. What is naive in this view is that employee quits, are not costless. So in economic terms, think about an important externality that malus-based incentives bring to the workplace as compared to bonus-based incentives. And this externality, of course, is taken into account by firms and is not taken into account by the basic theories that we've reviewed so far. And that, of course, results in the clear prevalence of bonus-based incentives rather than malus-based incentives. So that is my take on the question, and I believe that was the only question that people had of the course, right? Now, employee benefits. The course's name is Compensation and Benefits, right? So far we've been talking about compensation, which is the cash that you get on your bank account at the end of each month or whenever. But actually, there's more than that. And the big question before us today is why? There is something like insurance, vacation, and other perks. They're called perquisites. It's a nice Latin word meaning something extra, right? So there are a lot of perks that come with a salary. And the question is, why not just convert all these perks into cash and give it on top of the salary, right? So, and during the lecture today, we're going to look at some of the answers to this question. Now, before we actually attack this question head on, let's just take some time to appreciate the variety of employee benefits. Now, this is a picture I stole from Google Pictures. It's sort of course, is based on the United States practices of compensation benefits, but it's not. YMCA, Young Men Christian Association. I don't know if it's active in Germany, is it?
Yes.
Right, great. So, okay. So, life insurance, dental plan. You could see this. You could project this to the German environment, institutional legal environment quite easily, I think, right? So, they do a lot in the form of benefits, in terms of benefits. And actually, some of the benefits, for example, vacation time, right? Some of the benefits, for example, vacation time, are treated by most of the employees, not as a benefit. They're treated as an obligation of the employer. Right? So, free parking. I can tell you any number of interesting stories about parking. It's really becoming an issue, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse because there's more and more and more cars. Right? So, the University of Konstanz offers free parking to its a certain subset of its employees. I'm not sure if it's to all employees, but professors have free parking. The way it works is totally crazy, and it defies a lot of precepts of economics, but that's how it works. We get free parking, but the parking lots at the University of Konstanz, they are the property of and are managed by the municipality of the city of Konstanz. So there is parking lot north and parking lot south, and there's also parking lot east. You know this, right? Now, the staff has, the professorial staff has free parking on parking lot north and parking lot east. So how does it work? They're parking machines, and we get a plastic card which we insert in the machine, and we get a monthly ticket. So that's how it works. Those who do get these cards gets in effect free parking, and those who don't get this card, the cards have to pay $150 per day, right, or something like this. Are you driving? Right. Okay. So those who are driving, they can see what I mean. Now, you can calculate it works in a very crazy way, because the parking lot south is paid parking. Everybody has to pay, professors and students. And what you have is both students park both in the north and the south. Students don't gain anything between the north and the south, except for the marginally extra convenience of parking in the north, but they clog up the park place north for the professors, and so the professors can't take advantage of their free parking as a benefit. And so I would surmise that free parking as a benefit offered by the University of Konstanz and paid for by the University of Konstanz is actually not that effective. And that brings me to the really important issue. I'm not going to moan about the inconveniences of parking at the University of Konstanz. It was just like an example. But the question is much more serious than this. So all of these things cost money. Right? So wouldn't it be better for firms to convert all of these things into cash and offer it as an additional benefit to the workers. So that's question. That's really the big question. Now, the related question with which I think we'll sort of proceed is, the problem is, you know, the problem is, and the strong argument for converting these benefits into cash is the fact that people, there are some benefits here that people do not regard as benefits. So if you do not regard a certain benefit as a benefit, your valuation of this benefit is going to be very low. The cost of this benefit to your employer is the cost of paying for things, right, which may be higher than your valuation of the benefit. Now, the difference between the subjective valuation of the benefit by the employee and the monetary costs that the firm are paying for these, for the provision of these benefits, is clear inefficiency. Okay? So why does it exist? As an example of benefits, the many benefits that a firm called Qualcomm, operating in worldwide, offers to its employees based in Germany. It's just an illustration of the richness of the benefit. The benefits are not trivial. They're not trivial amount of the total salary. Look here. This is the total average hourly cost of compensation. So it costs $42.42 on average, PPP adjusted, to buy 1 hour of labor in Germany. Okay, quite a lot of money, average labor costs. Now, the social insurance, which is a major benefit, constitutes more than a fifth of this amount. All right? So, and then, you know, 4/5 of this amount are the total, is the direct pay. And even in this direct pay, a further fifth of the total is the directly paid benefits, such as holidays. These are the bonuses. They're not benefits. They're, I think, misclassified here, but still, right? So even if you look at here, these are direct benefits, right? Even if you look at here, there's quite a lot of money. Now, so what is the value of employee benefits versus their cash equivalent? And why do firms pay benefits? Then, once we've answered this big question, the rest will sort of follow. These issues are not that interesting, but we will just have an overview of them for the purposes of your general acquaintance with them. Now, why do firms pay benefits in addition to cash? There are a couple of reasons, and we're going to carefully discuss them. So reason number one is the boring reason, legal requirements. So more than a century of trade union movements worldwide has resulted in the institutionalization of some of the perquisites that the unions were arguing for in late 19th century, you know, waving red flags, etc. And then the firms, the governments who received an input from the left-wing spectrum of the political movement in their respective countries have imposed on the firms then the legal requirement to have paid holiday, to have paid sick leave, to pay towards employees' pension scheme, to pay towards employee social security insurance. So this is the pot of money from which your unemployment, well, I'm not saying yours, but you know, I hope not, but you know, people's unemployment benefit money will be paid. So all these costs are paid by the firms, but they are not paid by the firms voluntarily. So the first answer to the question why firms pay benefits is they have to. Now, there's, of course, a deeper question. If you consider the political process as some sort of very complicated game between different actors, the question is this outcome, how can we examine this outcome in terms of efficiency that it implies? Is it efficient to have an equilibrium in which in which firms pay benefits on top of cash to the workers. And, you know, there could be different perspectives on this, but we really don't have time to discuss them. I do want you to be aware of these reservations. For example, you know, workers might think, okay, today I'm young and healthy and I earn a lot of money and I live in a good place. Yeah. So why do I need to pay Social Security contribution? It's very unlikely that I will be unemployed because I'm so wonderful and I'm so healthy and I'm so productive and I went to good school and I tick a lot of boxes in terms of labor market characteristics. And yet it's these guys that are taxed like hell in order to fund the provision of benefits countrywide, right? So, and here is a worker who is not that healthy and not that young and whose skills are a little bit obsolete, and this worker might have a different perspective, right? Now, the sad reality is that a lot of these healthy, young, productive, gone to good school people in a few decades are likely to be in a position of being old and weary and with skills that are not too up to date, etc., etc. So, is it efficient to benefit, to offer benefits rather than to offer cash? Because, of course, if you offer cash, then the productive ones and the educated ones will get way more money than they get netto. But when it comes to old age, when it comes to sick age, they will get zero. And then they have to live off the savings that they may or may not have made in the fat periods. And the problem is that people typically underfund their pension schemes because of being naive, basically, and because of being hyperbolic discounters. But that's a totally different perspective. Now, so one lesson for us to learn is that it's a legal requirement. Okay, a more interesting reason is actually you could play a little bit with your tax contributions by offering some resources under the heading of benefits rather than cash. So, company car, for example, right, is an expense. Company car is an expense. You can tax deduct it as a firm. Now, as an employee, you may or may not have to pay income tax on this. I've seen both cases, actually, but in the majority of cases, people do pay the implied income tax on their company car, which makes the value of this benefit, of course, considerably lower. Suppose there is a government that comes up with an initiative to resolve some of the externalities that reduce the economic efficiency of its economy. For example, you know, we hear a lot about healthy eating, about healthy lifestyle, about, you know, walking, about doing sports. So there could be regulations, there could be ways to tax deduct the benefits in the form of, for example, gym membership, right? So people would get their benefit, they would get a gym membership voucher that they would otherwise have had to pay for, okay? So they value this. But for the firms, it will actually in the netto be cheaper because they can get some tax rebate on the costs of benefits. Now notice that every euro that you pay as a salary to your workers will cost you more than a euro, because you'll have to pay all these social security contributions and pension contributions on every euro of salary. So every euro of cash costs your firm more than a euro. Every euro of benefits that are tax deductible is going to cost you less than a euro in the net as a firm. So that's another very powerful reason for firms to offer benefits in addition to cash. Related to this is that, you know, it's very often the case that when you buy a large amount of benefits from the provider of these benefits, you get a bulk discount, right? So if I buy 1 month membership in the gym, I pay something between 25 and 40 euros, depending on the, you know, depending on what there is, right? But suppose I buy 10,000 monthly memberships, then, you know, there is a discount. And this discount, of course, I'm not going to share with my workers. I'm going to appropriate myself. And to the worker, they will all get a gym membership worth a certain amount of money. Okay, so there's some economy of scale to be enjoyed for the providers, by the providers of benefits. So that's sort of another accounting reason. Here's the most interesting reason for the purposes of this course. Here's the most interesting reason for the purposes of this course. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot about it and explain it with examples. A given benefit has different value for different people, right? And if the given amount of benefit, if the given nominal amount of benefit has different value for different people, then you can use benefits strategically to attract people to whom this benefit has the highest value. Because, of course, these people will be more willing to work for you because their utility from working for you will be enhanced by the benefit that fits them particularly well. Okay? So what sort of people do you want to hire in your firm? Of course, the default answer is, oh, I want to hire the most productive people I can procure. My money can buy. But this is a sort of a very naive answer. You know, of course, everybody wants to buy the most productive people. But we live in a world where, despite all this big data, it's very hard to say, it's very hard to diagnose who is productive and who is not. So firms have to use the detectable clues of productivity, the characteristics of people that are statistically reliably correlated with their performance outcomes. So in other words, you want to profile your workers and you want to attract the workers who are most productive given their characteristics. That's approach number one. Now, approach number two. You do not want to profile your labor force because it's too hard to do, or because it's illegal, or because or it doesn't fit your business strategy of being the employer of choice that speaks to all the strata of the society. So let's say you don't do employee profiling. You have the workers that you have, that you've hired, and you want to increase their, you want to improve their performance, the performance of your existing workers by tinkering with their compensation and benefit system. Now, how to improve the performance of your workers? By changing their CNB system. How would you do that? That's what we discussed for most of the course. How would you do this? In the sense of compensation, how would you improve the productivity of your existing workforce by changing compensation?
So, with the example, fixed wage for more risk-averse people, and
you will practice incentives, yeah. Right? So, very, very trivial. You know, to improve the productivity of existing workers, you need to practice incentives. There is a variety of incentives you can practice, and we discussed some of them. Not the incentives is not a panacea. Not all firms practice incentives, but I think the majority of firms practice incentives of some sort. It could be efficiency wage that we studied in this course. It could be pure incentives. It could be bonus. It could be piece rate. It could be career concerns, which we didn't study in this course, but it is a form of incentives. Okay, so everybody knows what career concerns is, right? Okay, so that's on the compensation side. Now, can you further improve the performance of your people by changing the benefits side of things? What do you think? How would you improve the performance of your existing workers by engineering your benefit system? I'm talking about existing employees. So you have existing employees, no vacancies, you're not hiring. No vacancies, here's the existing employees. How would you improve their productivity by engineering certain aspects of the benefit system? So how can you improve their productivity? You can improve their productivity by making them work harder. That's what you do with incentives, okay? It's hard to do it with benefits. But you can also improve people's productivity by making them less sick, by making them less stressed, by preventing their burnout, right? So you can improve productivity on the intensive margin, that is more effort per hour, okay? But you can also improve productivity along the what's called in economics extensive margin. You know this intensive, extensive margin? So intensive margin is per hour that they are present at work. Extensive margin is increase the number of hours that they are actually present at work, right? And how can you increase the amount of hours that they are actually present at work? You can make them less, you can try to make them less sick. You can try to make them less stressed. You can try to make them less depressed. Depression, medical depression, is a very terrible disease. People kill themselves, but for firms, it's also a very terrible disease because it's very long and very expensive. Okay? So what could you do with benefits? Well, you could offer gym memberships. People will get more fit. Lower likelihood of all sorts of diseases, more hours present at work, okay? So you can offer Kita to follow your example with Kita. Very excellent example, except that you were framing it with the purpose of attracting people, which is a good frame, but it's not answer to my question. So if you offer Kita, As a father of two children, I can tell you that Kita close to work removes a lot of stress. A lot of stress, okay? So you can be a lot more productive and you're going to be absent a lot less of the time at your work, right? So now that my children have their school holidays and I'm here giving a lecture in compensation and benefits, I need to worry about childcare. But if I have childcare provided for by my work, I would be a lot more efficient in the work that I'm doing. So the University of Constance offers a Kita, and it's I think either free or charges some nominal amounts, very small. And you know, when I sit in my office, which is in front of the Kita, I see a lot of my colleagues bringing their children to Kita, taking their children to Kita. So this is really working, and these people are a lot happier in their work. They're a lot less likely to quit, etc., etc. So you could try to think about what you could look at the people who you employ, and you could think to yourself, what is it that could make their lives easier? What is it that could make their lives healthier? Okay? And you could try to enable the arrangements that make their lives easier and healthier for your existing employees. Now, you could, you know, as a devil's advocate, you could argue, but surely a bit of cash will make the life of your employees also somewhat easier because they could use it to pay for childcare or for whatever they feel like paying. So you could say, well, if you care about Kita so much, why don't we convert the costs of Kita on a commercial basis into an increment on your wage, and you will, you know, have this as a cash. And then you will be in a position to think, oh, maybe I should send my child to Kita for half time, and you know, maybe you could arrange with your partner that your partner works half time or you work half time, so that the other half of the time they will be the child care will be provided domestically and half of the time child care will be provided externally, but you will have a certain budget for child care that your firm has cashed in for you, and you can use it for, you know, buying a sports car, for example, if you're into it. Okay, so that's certainly a possibility. I would very much like to have my so-called free parking converted into cash, which would enable me to not fight for parking places with students in their shabby cars in the Park Place North and park it in the South. I hate it. So all these students should go to the South and give me my free parking in the Park Place North. Yes. How ridiculous I sound. Now, cashing in my free parking benefits would make it less ridiculous, right? I would just be cool. I would just go to Park Place South and would not have to fight with students, you know? So, some benefits, there's really a case for cashing in some benefits, just giving them as cash. However, remember two things. First, whenever you cash something, it becomes your labor costs. And if it's your labor costs, remember, every euro of your labor costs costs you more than a euro. So if you want to cash a certain benefit, you have a painful choice of either increase your costs and therefore decrease your profit, or pay the workers a lower cash equivalent of what they would have spent on childcare. Okay, and that's a painful choice, and not all firms do this. Not all firms are prepared to make this choice, right? So they say, okay, here's a benefit, take it or leave it. The second reason is because even your existing people are very different in terms of their circumstances. It will take a lot of administrative effort to successfully administer the very complicated, what would have been a very complicated system where people could choose benefits or cash them in, you know? So now that my children are small, okay, they are older than Kita age, but, you know, so I don't need a Kita, but suppose my children were of a Kita age. So, okay, let's say 5 and 3, they have to go to Kita. I come to the University of Konstanz. The University of Konstanz is telling me, okay, we have a free Kita for you, but you know what? You can cash it. I say, okay, let's cash it. Or I say, okay, let's send the children to Kita. Now the children go to Kita and then they go to school. Schools are free in Germany. And I still get this Kita, free Kita, which I don't need. You know, I don't want to go there myself and eat the kids' food, you know, to make use of the benefit. And so I come to the finance office of the University of Konstanz and say, guys, you know what? I've changed my mind, and now I'd like to cash the Kita benefit. Okay, I get Kita benefit in cash. Then let's say, for example, I have another child, so I need a Kita again. I come to the finance office and say, I want Kita. And then the child grows up and I say, I want cash. And then I'm really old, the children have grown up, and some of the children are struggling financially. They come to me and say, you know, Dad, can you sort of cash in your Kita benefit, historical Kita benefit, and give me the cash to pay for the actual Kita for my children, for example? Think about how much complication and corruption maybe this system would entail. So the benefits in kind system may actually be an efficient solution to address a complex set of problems. First, differences in individual circumstances and stages of life cycle of people. And second, you know, the need to provide conditions and arrangements for people to improve their productivity on the extensive margin by making them less sick, by making them less burnt out, less depressed, and less willing to leave your organization. And of course, we also can use benefits to attract people. And that brings me back to your point, the point you made earlier. You know, suppose we have vacancies and we want to attract people. Who do we want to attract? Most productive people, etc. Right? Let's say we have an idea of who we want to attract. And this idea may be right, it may be wrong, it may be a fad, it may be actually more than a fad, it may be the need to modernize your workforce in order to be more aware of the modern world in which you are trying to operate. So you want to attract particular employees, and you could figure out which benefits would have the highest value for these employees and design your existing compensation benefits package in a way that would be attractive to these employees. Here's an example. So there is absolutely no deficit of literature, academic literature, and also, of course, a lot of journalism, blogs, newspaper articles, TV programs, etc., on the issue of equal gender representation in the workplace. So you have women still slightly underrepresented in the workplace, and you have women grossly underrepresented in some workplaces, such as tech, the tech industry, right? So you have a great development there, and you see a lot more female tech executives, entrepreneurs, engineers, etc., than before. But still, some people argue that, you know, not all women who could have worked in tech, who have the potential to work in tech, who are good at maths and physics and engineering, actually end up working in tech. And the reason is, the work is hard, the work is stressful, and people won't have children, and they need to take time off to have their children. But by the time they will have nursed their children, they are already obsolete for the labor market and cannot, you know, make up with the developments of the industry after the few years that they have to spend with their children nursing them. So what happens as a result is that a lot of female employees in the tech industries, they make lifestyle choices that post factum they may not be very comfortable with. So here's the firms Apple and Facebook that I've checked it more recently. So this is the newspaper clipping, which is quite old, but I've checked it's still up to date. So they are offering what you might think of as a very exotic benefit. But see, here's what they're offering. They are offering to freeze eggs for their female employees. Okay, so, you know, there are different chances of getting pregnant with age, and typically as with age, the likelihood of getting pregnant goes down. Now, so you could choose as a female employee of Apple or Facebook to have some of your eggs frozen, in order to increase the chance of having children later in your life, when you've met all your performance requirements and you are in the safe, senior, high-paying enough job to, you know, really take your time to look after your children. So they have been doing it, and this is the justification. This benefits policy is designed to attract and keep top female talent by helping them avoid having to choose between motherhood and professional progression. Okay? So if you want to attract female employees, you could offer them this benefit. Now, suppose you want to attract male employees. This benefit would not really, you know, if I saw this benefit on the long list of benefits that University of Constance is offering to me, I would call the finance department and say, guys, how about cashing it? You know, this is an example. It may be exotic, but I think it really illustrates the point that different benefits have different value for different people. And the composition of the benefits package can be used strategically to attract and keep the type of people who you want to attract and keep. Now, here's another example. Cash for education. Now, let's go back a few years into your economics education to labor econ basic, right? So, if you go back a few years in your education, you may recall when you studied human capital, there is general human capital and firm-specific human capital, right? So, and the basic economics tells you that firms should sponsor the development of firm-specific human capital, but they should not sponsor the development of general human capital. Why? Because if it's general human capital, the workers can get return on this human capital within the firm as well as outside the firm. And so the workers, when they leave the firm, get higher wages elsewhere, will result in this firm actually losing money on sponsoring general human capital for them. Now, so the prediction of this basic theory of human capital is that firms should do very specific training for very specific skills for the profession and the firm where people are working, but firms should not sponsor, for instance, university education. Okay. But if you go out there, you'll see that actually a lot of firms, even in Germany, sponsor university education. There's even a scheme. What's its name? Our German students, can you help me? There is a scheme in Germany where people work in firm part of the time and part of the time they go to uni. Something like that. Right? Have you heard about it? Okay. Now, that's clearly inconsistent. But why do they do this? Well, it's useful to look at it, at this practice, through the prism of compensation and benefits. Okay? So, you have a certain amount of money that you want to spend on benefits. You don't want to cash them. You don't want to cash this money. Okay. And part of the benefits could be cash for education, this duales studium, for instance, scheme. Right? So you have a salary, and then you have a long, long list of benefits, something like this. And some of this could be cash for education. So this is a very good example that shows the use of benefits to attract and retain the people the firm wants to attract and retain. Now, the cash for education as a benefit has different value for different people. Now, for the people who are not very aspiring and motivated, for the people for whom studying is really a pain and they just want to work and they don't want to increase their human capital further, cash for education doesn't have a lot of benefit because they probably won't go and study again. But for people who are motivated and aspiring, for people who actually want to move on the hierarchical ladder, who want to get this degree after that degree, this certificate after that certificate in order to become a manager, in order to become more and more productive and influential in their firm, cash for education is really the ingredient that will greatly improve the value, their individually perceived value of the benefits package for them. If firms want to attract this type of people, they could try to do so by offering cash for education. Okay, so, and here's another newspaper clipping. Employers use education benefits to attract workers. College savings plan, launched in late 2012, helped the company to have virtually no turnover at corporate headquarters and less recruiting costs. So why no turnover? Well, these plans are typically long-term and they have a lot of clauses. For example, if you get your university education or education subsidy at the expense of the firm and leave this firm in less than X years, you'll have to return the costs of subsidy. So you stay on. And then you stay on, you get promoted, you probably buy a house in the neighborhood of your workplace, so you become less mobile and you stick with this firm and, you know, no turnover, okay? So, I mentioned earlier on in this lecture that there are different people. You know, you deal with different people in the workplace. People differ in terms of their characteristics. Look at University of Constance. There are younger employees, there are older employees, there are employees with children, employees without children, there are female employees, there are male employees. There are employees who drive and therefore need free parking, and there are employees who don't drive and would therefore prefer to have their free parking cashed, you know, to have an additional benefit, right? So you can either have a very complicated and susceptible to corruption system of offering each individual worker the opportunity to choose or choose not a particular benefit, right? Or you could have a scheme which is sort of halfway between totally standardized benefit scheme and the totally unstandardized benefit scheme, and that's called cafeteria plan. So, University of Constance, to my knowledge, like these lectures being video recorded, and if something is factually incorrect, please let me know. But to my knowledge, the University of Constance operates a fixed benefit system, so that the benefits nomenclature, the benefits that we're given as employees of the University of Constance are fixed for every employee within a certain employee group, such as, for example, professors or postdocs or admin workers or management or technical staff. Okay, so what is a cafeteria plan? Let's go back to a few years ago when I was an assistant professor at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. Tilburg University in the Netherlands has what's known as cafeteria plan. It was actually called cafeteria plan. So you log in to your university employee webpage using your login number and password, and you have a lot of options there, okay? And one of the options is benefits. You go, click options benefits. I wish I could get some screenshots, but it's too late now. So you have options, and you can click options or you can unclick options, and it's like you're shopping on eBay. The interface is very similar, right? So you can click insurance or express delivery costs, or you can unclick insurance or express the delivery costs. So you have, as an employee of the University of Tilburg, you have certain fixed benefits which are non-negotiable and are available for everyone. But you also had quite a lot of benefits that were that you could choose. And if you click this benefit, you would see how much it costs you. So you have a certain budget of money that the University of Tilburg says, okay, this is the cash value of your benefits, and now use this cash value to choose the benefits you'd like to have. And each benefit that you choose costs certain amount of money, which is then subtracted from your cash amount. And then when you finished, you press the ready button and you have the plan. So you can choose no benefits at all, and then you will receive this cash as part of your salary, and you will pay an extra income tax on this cash, a progressive income tax. Or if you choose benefits within this cash budget, you will receive these benefits without consequences for your income tax. So it was actually quite an attractive offer. And you had lots and lots of benefits there. I don't remember all of these benefits, but the basic benefits were the transportation ticket was there, the extra holiday allowance was also there, the ophthalmologist voucher was there, so you could get your, you know, spectacles to read student exams better. So some trips, enhanced health insurance, in so you could get more comprehensive health insurance or dental insurance. And once every quarter, I think, or half a year, don't remember anymore, once every so many months, you could revisit your choices on this webpage and change them if you want to, right? So suppose this scheme was in operation at the University of Konstanz. There's a benefits budget, and you could spend some of your benefits on so many days at Kita, or you know, when your children grow up, you untick these boxes and you spend your benefits on so many days of holidays, for example, right? So that's called cafeteria plan. And why is it cafeteria? I think it's a very talking name. Because that's how cafeteria works, right? You go to Mensa, you see a choice of food, you make your choices, you know, so such and such soup, such and such salad, main course, dessert or no dessert, beer or no beer, and then you bring this to the cash desk and you pay for the choice that you've made, okay? And different people make different choices. Now another another scheme which I think makes it even more similar to the cafeteria plan. You enter the cafeteria and they say lunch costs 6 euros, let's say, okay. And here are the choices that you can make within this 6 euro budget. And if you make more choices, then you have to pay some extra. So that's also a variant of cafeteria plan. So it has a lot of advantages. It has a lot of advantages, and the main advantage of cafeteria plan is, of course, unparalleled flexibility of this plan. This is the state of the art. This is the industry best practice in benefits management that speaks to the diverse needs of whatever part of the workforce that you want to attract and retain in your organization. So you don't need to be too strategic. You can be. But you don't have to be, right? In designing a universally applicable benefits plans, right? You could do cafeteria, and then people will have the option to choose frozen eggs as a benefit or cash them in. And this way, you will attract both people who are interested in having their eggs frozen and people who are not interested in having their eggs frozen, right? So that's of course a major advantage of cafeteria plan. Now, looking at the practice, you see that not all firms have cafeteria plan. University of Konstanz, for example, doesn't have a cafeteria plan. Why? It's very expensive to administer. Imagine, you know, if you have a fixed benefits plan, you already have a team. You need to have a team of people, so one person would not be able to do that. You need to have a team of people who would liaise with the providers of benefits, who would do the paperwork, who would do all these income tax submission work for the benefits to administer just one universal uniform benefit scheme. Now, when you are having a cafeteria plan, it means that you have to have people dealing with all these choices at all the possible periods of time that people might feel like changing their choices, and that creates a lot of extra admin work that not all firms are prepared to pay for, right? So there's an advantage in terms of great flexibility, but there's also a disadvantage in terms of higher costs, of course. That makes sense. More flexibility, higher costs. Okay, now, so why do firms pay benefits? These are the reasons why firms pay benefits in addition to cash. To better understand the reasons and challenges in the administration of benefit schemes, it's also important to understand that different people have different appreciation of the benefits that are offered to them. But the appreciation of the benefits offered to different people depends not only on their individual circumstances. This side of the question, I think, we have explored already. It also depends on how people perceive, on whether people perceive benefits as value delivered to them by their firm, or do they perceive benefits as some sort of entitlement that firms have no choice in giving, or whether people actually know that there are benefits. And it turns out, quite unexpectedly to me, this is really, you know, the most sensational part of this lecture. It appears that a lot of people don't know what benefits they get. It's a bit like you pay a wage of, say, 10 euros per hour to the workers. And this wage includes cash of, let's say, 8 euros per hour and benefits worth of 2 euros per hour, right? So the actual wage is 10 euros per hour. But people don't know about the other 2 euros, so people believe that they get 8 euros per hour. It's that bad. And of course, why is it that bad? Because it's clearly inefficient. Think about it as some sort of tax. Think about it in terms of very basic supply and demand framework. On the supply side, you would have people who are willing to work for 8 euros per hour. But on the demand side, you would have firms that are having to pay 10 euros per hour. So think about the inefficiency and deadweight loss in terms of underemployment or under provision of effort. If we think about intensive margins, that this information symmetry creates. So employees are a lot less aware of their benefits and appreciate them a lot less than cash. How do we know this? Let's open the textbook on page 431 to 432. There isn't that much information. I think it would make a very ambitious, but if successful, a really great master thesis. If you care about writing a master thesis with me, it would make a great master thesis to survey, systematically survey the literature on how people perceive benefits, because there is very little of this literature, even in the textbook. So, but from the little that we know, the consistent message that appears is that employees are not really well aware of their benefits. They interviewed a bunch of people. They gave them a questionnaire, and one of the questions was, can you list the benefits that your current employer offers to you? And they listed such and such benefits. Okay, we have benefit this, benefit that, benefit the other. And then when they compared the answers of people and the actual benefits that their firms offered to them, they found that the average employee recalls less than 15% of the total list of benefits that was available to them. So all these frozen eggs, cash for education, free parking, young male Christian association membership, dental plans, ophthalmological plans, keto plans, green office plans, working from home plans, seasonal ticket, all these hundreds of benefits that firms have been spending their time, money, administrative effort putting together, forget it. 15%, less than 15% of those are even known to the workers. All right? So this is really a big problem. Result number two from the limited literature on the appreciation of benefits. Again, questionnaire-based, not really very structural, nothing causal there, right? Nothing deeply econometric, but, you know, very interesting piece of anecdotal information. So they asked a bunch of people who were looking for jobs. They asked them to rate the aspects of job that they considered important on the 1 to 7 scale, don't remember, right? So and they say that, so the job has, of course, the cash, the convenience of location, the sense of a mission, all these characteristics, and of course the benefits. So you have a bunch of characteristics, and a bunch of people had to rate these characteristics in terms of their importance. Now guess what? The benefits are the least important aspect of the job, the least important. Now, benefits, which in Germany make up more than a fifth of the total labor costs, benefits that are hundreds in their name, in their types, benefits that take so much effort and money to administer, are considered the least important by job seekers. Now, try to make the following two findings talk to each other, and what you will hear is a conflict. Point number one that we considered earlier, that benefits can be used to attract the people who you want and to make the people who you have more productive. And we saw that in theory it should work, and we saw some newspaper clippings suggesting that firms are trying to do that. So that's point number one. Point number two, people don't know about them. And even if they do know about them, they're not very important. They're not very important, right? So that's really a problem. The problem is that firms are wasting resources trying to strategically manage their human resources by creating advantageous benefit schemes, but employees don't care about them. Why not? Why don't employees care about the benefit system offered to them? A couple of reasons, actually a good few reasons. Reason number one, so there is a culture of entitlement to benefits. For example, if you ask people, you know, as a survey, they will tell you, and they will rightly tell you, that, for example, such benefits, expensive benefits, as holiday pay, as sick leave, and social security contributions are an entitlement, right? It's not that firms are spending their hard-earned cash paying for these benefits, right? Firms have to do it. It's not even that firms have to do it. It's that people think that by the virtue of their existence, they are entitled to these benefits, right? It's somehow their human right to receive these benefits. That's what most people think. Now, looking at the list of human rights, there's no human right to a benefit. Yeah? And yet, people think that benefit is a human right. Now, and of course, what happens when these benefits are changed? It creates a lot of wrath. It creates a lot of protest, right? Think about, you know, increasing the pension age, which keeps going up because people live longer, right? Now, each time pension age is increased, there's a lot of protests against it. Okay, so I don't want to discuss whether this protest is right or not. It's not the purpose of the course. People are entitled to their own opinions, but the point I want to make is that, you know, the real threat to the efficiency of benefit schemes lies in the culture of people thinking that they are somehow human rightly entitled to these benefits. Okay, let me think about, I don't know. Let's say that free parking benefit is a legal requirement. It's not. I'm saying, for example, it's not a legal requirement. It's not. Fortunately, it's not a legal requirement, right? So even though I'm a committed car driver, I'm not that naive to, you know, think that it's fortunately not a legal requirement. But let's say it is a legal requirement. So wherever Nick goes to work, and Nick has changed 5 jobs in his life, wherever he goes to work, he has to be given a parking place. Free of charge, okay? Now, will he care and will he appreciate the free parking opportunity given by his new employer? No, because everybody has to do this. So, if people do not appreciate the value of this benefit given by their employer, think about behavioral economics that you so like. Okay, think about behavioral economics and think about reciprocity and gift exchange. Okay, so it's important for people to value and appreciate the benefits given to them by their firms for the gift exchange to be enabled. You give your employees a benefit, the benefits reciprocate, the employees reciprocate the value of the benefits in terms of higher effort. Okay? Now, if you have to give these benefits because it's a legal requirement, people will not reciprocate or will reciprocate a lot less. Okay? So, and what it creates is it creates a situation in which labor productivity remains the same because people do not work harder in appreciation of the benefits. Maybe labor productivity will be a little bit higher because people will be less likely to be late for work now that they have free parking. Okay, so you will have an increase in productivity, but it will not be the increase in productivity that it will not be to its maximum level because it will not be fueled by gift exchange, right? So you have a labor productivity not really going up very much. You have labor costs going up because on top of pension, holiday, sick leave, firms have to have a budget for free parking, and that costs money, right? So you have to have parking places, you have to pay for them, yeah? So labor costs go up, labor productivity does not go up that much. In a very basic demand and supply framework, what will be the consequence? Less employment, more unemployment. Right? Of course, in the real world, the consequences are wider. So you may not see immediately an increase in unemployment because of the free parking requirement. What you will see is a gradual deterioration of other aspects of work. So firms will say, okay, now that we have to offer free parking, let us strengthen the sanctions that we impose on people for being late for work. How about that? So the working conditions will deteriorate. Yes, you will have free parking and unemployment, and this is actually a good outcome because at least no one is going to lose their job. But there's nothing for free. And if you think it's for free, think again. And so you will end up paying for this no matter whether it's legal requirement or an entitlement. But specifically for the firms, once again, it bears repeating that it's a problem because they have to pay for something and they will not get as much effort response in return. So, how to manage the benefit system in the efficient way? Oh, we are approaching the end of the lecture, right? So I suggest we take a break. So, okay. Now, let's move on to the less controversial topic of the importance of the benefit management. Why is it less controversial than human rights and the United Nations? Is because I think we can agree on that. Benefits are expensive to administer. It's a fifth of the total labor costs in Germany. And there are theoretical arguments, and some behaviors of firms that are consistent with theoretical arguments that point out to the potential of using benefits for strategic purposes, namely attracting and retaining the talent that the firms prefer. But the problem is that, you know, people take benefits for granted. Another problem is that people don't know that benefits exist. And yet, that's basically it. And if people don't know that benefits exist, how possibly can you use benefits for strategic purposes? You first need to make sure that people know that benefits exist. And that's going to be point number one on the agenda of this part of today's lecture. So the big question is, how can you strengthen the perceived value of benefits? Okay, so point number one, you need to improve the benefits visibility. So how do you improve benefits visibility? You have to communicate benefits better. Have you are in a master program, so it means that you may or may not have had, have you had a proper job market experience? Have you had a sort of an ordinary job, not a student job, not an internship, but like an ordinary job, maybe part-time, maybe full-time? Have you had an ordinary job? Do you remember the offer that you received for this job, or was it informal?
It was like a contract.
It was a contract?
Yeah.
Okay, so try to remember how your contract looked like. Was it a contract or was it an offer saying, "Dear Sarah, we're pleased to offer you this job"?
An offer.
Okay. Now, what was the most striking thing in that offer for you? What was the one element in that offer that you remember the most?
My salary.
That's right. Not surprising. What was the second most important piece of information in that offer that you remember?
The working times.
Okay, so working conditions. So from, I don't know, 8 to 5 or 9 to 6, or, you know, evenings or weekends, doesn't matter. So the working conditions in terms of working times. Anything else that really emblazoned on your memory in that offer? No. So anything you remember from that offer that spoke about benefits that came with your job?
There were, but...
Okay, tell us.
Private hospital.
Okay.
Allowance. You also had like the thing where you could do more than 10,000 steps to get a bonus.
Oh, excellent. Which country was it?
Mexico.
Was Mexico?
Yeah.
Great. Sounds very North American. So right. Okay. Right. So this information was communicated to you in the job offer letter.
Yeah.
Right? So when you entered your job, did you discover any further benefits?
Yeah, like movie, you had free access to like movie theaters or and also you think you had free passes to the theater?
So there were benefits that were not mentioned in the offer letter that you discovered later on. How did you discover them?
Email.
So email, it was a circular email to... Oh, great. And when did you discover it? The first day, the first month,
within
the first month. So this is actually a pretty good way of communicating benefits. I think your employer would score very highly in terms of the practices of benefits communication. Because first they told you about, let's say, the most important benefits already in the offer letter, and they gave you precise figures for these benefits. Okay? So then very quickly they communicated to you in an official way about the existence of other benefits. Okay? So that would rank them very highly. What happens in many other firms? Right? What happens in many other firms, including the organizations that I personally work at, I don't want to make it too anecdotal. I don't want to make it too person focused, right? But this is actually, you know, these anecdotes are helpful as examples of the actual practices of benefits communication. The strange thing is that when you receive a job offer, this job offer does not typically communicate the benefits to you. It communicates the cash. So it's like your actual wage is 10 euros per hour, but your job offer is telling you it's 8. Right? So think about the effect it has on your labor supply, and think about the inefficiency this lack of communication creates. Then another problem with problem one in benefit communication, it's not communicated at the initial stage of an employment relationship in the job offer. Okay, so that would make it very, visible, but many firms don't do that for reasons that are interesting, right? So another topic for master thesis could be just to run a survey of benefits communication practices in firms. You know, you could just send letters to firms, can you please fill in our survey and get some interesting statistics about it. It would make a wonderful thesis, you know. Maybe not master, although maybe with a little bit of theory, maybe even a master thesis, but it would make an excellent bachelor thesis for sure, right? So then another deficiency when it comes to benefit visibility communication is that employees don't learn about the benefits that they actually have, okay? So, or they learn about the benefits that they actually have through informal channels like word of mouth, which may create various misgivings about the firm's intentions in the provision of its benefits to the workers, right? So there are clear ways of improving benefit communication. You have to give either a reference to a separate document that details the benefits to the workers, with figures and other precise parameters, or if it's not too many benefits, or if you can fit them into the one page of job offer letter, you could list them in a job offer letter. You have to communicate things to make them prominent. It's really as simple as that. Okay, and you should avoid imperfect communications, post factum communications about the benefits existing in the firms thereafter. So maybe, you know, if benefits would be communicated in more explicit, official, documental way, maybe people would care to remember more than 15% of the benefits available to them, as we know from one of the studies cited in the textbook. Now, one sort of semi-automatic way of making benefits visible is to practice cafeteria plans, right? So this cafeteria plan, it has an interesting psychological phenomenon. As I said, it works online, and the sort of the setting is very similar to the online shopping that people, you know, choosing an air ticket or choosing a book on Amazon, choosing any product you buy on the internet these days. So you learn about product characteristics, you can do some calculations, you can compare one benefit with the other and decide which one is best value for you given the costs of this benefit. So cafeteria plan is actually an excellent tool, not only to increase flexibility, which it obviously does to the best extent possible, but also to improve the visibility of the benefit. That is quite important to make the benefits being perceived as a valuable addition to the the compensation package that firms have prepared. So, both these solutions, better benefit communication and flexible benefit plans, such as cafeteria plans, require additional resources, of course, such as planning, design, and administration. And, you know, let's just quickly go through them, and then we'll see what questions people have, if they have any questions, and then we'll move on to the one of the past exams. So these are the benefits planning and design issues. Attracting and retaining the right employees. So let's assume you have an idea about what sort of employees you want to attract and retain. Then you have to understand the utility that people derive from different benefits at different stages in their life cycle. Okay, so a given benefit has different value to people in different life circumstances. So a good cafeteria benefit plan would have the choice of benefits that people, given type of people, would find attractive at different stages of their life cycle if you want to retain these people for a long time. So dealing with undesirable turnover, it has to do with benefit planning and design issues, you know? So people, when they don't receive their incentives or when they have their salary withdrawn as a result of the malus type of incentives that we discussed later, that we discussed earlier today and earlier in the course, they may be more likely to quit. But to prevent people from quitting, you can also do something on the benefits side. And to do this, it's important not only to design the right set of benefits that would be attracted to people at different stages of their life cycle, you could also add a dosage of institutionalism into the design of your benefit scheme. For example, benefits increasing with seniority may be a credible alternative to deferred pay compensation or to other cash compensation solutions that differentiate between people with different tenure. Right? So people with people in a relatively junior positions or with a relatively small tenure will get a less prestigious company car, less expensive company car than people with higher tenure or higher positions, this kind of solutions, which are pretty universal. So ensuring external competitiveness. So last week we were talking about internal alignment and external competitiveness, if you remember. So internal alignment is a relationship between salaries and seniority. And internal alignment requires that more senior people should get higher salaries, right? That's internal alignment. Now, external competitiveness is the relationship between the salary that you're paying to a particular employee and the salaries paid to the same type of employees on the market by other firms. And very often we learned in previous lecture that often there's a conflict between internal alignment and external competitiveness, and the bulk of the literature, including the textbook that we're using as background reading for this course, tends to prefer external competitiveness to internal alignment, saying that when there's a conflict between the two, go for external competitiveness and forget about internal alignment. But breaking internal alignment is not inconsequential, because if there is a breach of internal alignment, then the part that feels itself offended might want to quit, and that will create unwanted disturbance to the way things are done in the firm. So benefits could be used, like salary, as an additional lever that firms can put in order to harmonize external competitiveness and internal alignment. So if you want to hire a junior manager, and the going salary for junior managers on the market these days is, I don't know, $150,000 a year, but there is a senior manager in your firm who has been working in your firm for 35 years. He's a senior manager and he receives $85,000 a year, right? So what do you do? There's a conflict between internal alignment and external competitiveness. What do you do? You could say, you know what, I'm going to pay what the market pays, and if you, Mr. Senior Manager, are not happy with your wage relative to the wage of your junior colleague, you may want to go to the market and try to get yourself a better wage. That's one thing. Now, suppose you do want to keep your senior manager and you don't feel like increasing his wage to make it market competitive. What you could do? You could play around on the benefit side of things. You could say, okay, I can't pay you as much cash. I'm not going to pay you as much cash as the market is paying, but you'll get a better office. You'll get an office with a view on Bodensee rather than in the courtyard. And your junior colleague, you may have a higher salary because that's how much the market pays, that's how much I need to pay to get this type of person into the firm, but because they're junior, they will get a smaller office with a less spectacular view. So that's an example when benefits can be used to harmonize to some extent the conflict between external alignment, external competitiveness, and internal alignment. So, ensuring that benefits are adequate and cost-effective, that's probably the most important issue when it comes to benefits planning and design. And there are two groups of questions. Number one, what do you buy for a given benefit value? And this question goes beyond simple accounting calculations. Of course, it does include accounting calculations. But it goes beyond that, because you need to take into account how people perceive these benefits and how important these benefits are for their effort decisions and for their turnover decisions, which is, of course, a much more strategic management question than an accounting question. But coming to the accounting questions, what do you buy for a given benefit value? How would you calculate the costs of the benefit administered to the workers? What are the elements you would include there, right? Now, there is a principle in accounting called total economic costs calculation. Have you heard of it? Total economic costs? Probably not, right? Doesn't matter. If you get to work with these things, you will learn through special trainings what total economic costs are and how to calculate them in your particular firm. What is important to understand is that one mistake that narrow specialists in their field are very likely to make is to assume that the costs of the benefit is the nominal costs that you pay to the provider of the benefit, which is not the case. The costs of the benefit is the nominal cost minus the tax savings that this benefit brings. You need to take into account the tax savings that this benefit brings if the benefitable activity is tax deductible, plus the costs of administration of these benefits in your organization. So there are on top of the nominal, very easily calculable costs of benefits, there is a benefit component, a plus, a positive component, and a negative component, right? So the costs of benefit is reduced by the implied tax savings on this benefit, plus, of course, bulk discount, but that's part of the nominal price. But it is increased by the costs of administering this benefit system. And these costs can be calculated, of course, not very precisely, but they can be calculated using some sort of formula, experiential formula, that takes into account the salaries and benefits and office costs and utility costs linked to the administration of the benefit scheme. And these costs can actually be quite substantial and prevent firms from operating cafeteria benefit plans despite the huge boost to benefit flexibility and visibility that these schemes deliver. So are there ethical issues in the benefit scheme? That's probably quite a sensitive matter. Here's an example of a benefit scheme that many people have considered to be hugely unethical. This example is from the North American practice. As far as I know, correct me, please, those not only here but also listening to me online, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm factually wrong. I will be happy to make an announcement to this effect. But to my knowledge, this practice is not practiced in Germany. Okay, so what practice am I talking about? Now, one practice that many firms offer internationally, actually, is life insurance. So one of the least known benefits that University of Constance employees get, and it took me a year to find out, is travel insurance while on business trips. So when I'm on a business trip, I get travel insurance, and it includes medical assistance, and it includes the repatriation of mortal remains in the lethal case, in the case of death. So I didn't know about this, but there is this benefit. It costs some money. Now, and there's a thing called life insurance. Life insurance is like life insurance, the typical insurance against the case of death, but there is also a savings part to it. So you could actually cash it, your life insurance, at a later point. So firms can buy life insurance and they can offer these life insurances to their employees as part of the benefits. And employees like it because it gives them additional financial security. Now, when things go a little sour is when firms buy life insurance on behalf of their employees, but the beneficiary in the life insurance is the firm itself. So I have a life insurance. The beneficiary of my life insurance is my wife. But if I worked in one of those firms, I could have 15 life insurances, and one of these life insurance would be my private life insurance, and 14 life insurances would be, in those 14 life insurances, the beneficiary would be my employer. Now, in case of my death, of course, the receiver of the insurance money would be the beneficiary in a policy, in a policy, right? Now, here's a question. Is this legal? The answer is, it's perfectly legal. In fact, there is a practice, a legally recognized practice called key person insurance policy, which is actually legally recognized to the extent that it's a business expense, which is subtractable from income tax. So you as a firm can have an insurance in case the death, in case of death of a very important manager in your firm. And that makes a lot of sense. When Steve Jobs died, on the day of his death, and he was quite sick for a long time before he died, so the market has sort of incorporated the news that he was on his way out. But on the day that he died, the Apple share fell by 5%. And it's a huge decrease, right? So firms can actually sustain quite a lot of damage from the death of important people there. And so it makes sense and it's perfectly legal to buy the life insurance on whose beneficiaries are the firms to insure themselves against the event of the death of an important people. Now, but how about buying a life insurance on the death of Nick, who is not a CEO, who is not a chief financial officer, who is just a university professor among the 500 or so university professors, right? How about buying a life insurance on his death? So will the University of Constance be in huge turmoil the day he dies? Probably not, right? Okay, a couple of lectures will have to be rescheduled, but never mind. And this practice covered more, progressively more and more and more employees. Now, and then people started asking questions. The legal question was answered pretty quickly. The practice is perfectly legal, because if you hire a good lawyer, they can write a justification that this cleaner or this machine operative or this cashier in a supermarket is so crucial to the success of the firm that his or her death would cause a huge havoc to the operations. That's good. Now, is this practice ethical? So, is this practice ethical? Very important question. It almost sounds like a tutorial question. And to be honest, I don't have an answer for this. Just take this question into your brain and think about it. So, on the very naive side of things, right? On the very naive side of things, in terms of ethical implications, it's a bit like, you know, if you take insurance in case of somebody's death, let's say you buy an insurance and you will get a certain amount, and you will be making monthly payments. And when I die, you get a certain amount of money. Is this ethical? On the one hand, one cannot see really difference between this insurance and the event when people come to a bookmaker's store, you know, the bookmakers, the people who take bets on sporting events, on political events, etc. You know what I'm talking about? I don't know if this exists in Germany. No, in England, it's actually quite popular. So you have a special place where you could come and make your bet on sporting event. You can bet certain amount of money on France winning or Belgium winning or whatever. And if the event happens, you get the premium. If the event does not happen, you don't get the premium. Now, you could come to such shop and make a bet on the death of a particular person. If a person dies, you get a premium. If a person doesn't die, you don't get a premium. What's wrong with that? On the one hand. You know? On the other hand, there were a lot of, actually, a lot of complaints. There were a lot of complaints from people. Well, here's a news clip from New York Times, which is a sort of centrist leftist newspaper in the United States. Wall Street Journal doesn't publish a lot of papers like this. So here's a case, you know, Walmart that pays peanuts and gets a lot of employees on really, really low pay, buys lots of life insurances, these people die, and their families are struggling to bury their dead because, of course, they don't have a funeral insurance and they may not even have their own life insurance. And then the relatives of these people come to Walmart saying, look, our father or our mother died and we are struggling. Can you help us at least bury them? And they say, sorry, we did have life insurance on them, but they were not paying for their life insurance. We were paying for the life insurance. And therefore, we feel like we are the only recipient of the life insurance money for this person. And it creates a lot of hard feelings. Now, let's look at the company side of the argument. And on the company side of the argument, it's really a very profitable business proposition. So if you find yourself working in a bank in North America, make sure you buy life insurance, maybe even 5 life insurances for every employee that you employ. Because there are only benefits. Look, first of all, if you get insurance payments in case of death, that's tax-free. You don't have to pay any tax on them. And, you know, given the tax wedge substantial, you know, there's a lot of money there. Benefit number two, perhaps even more important, that do you know this? Tier one capital? There's a so-called Basel agreement or Basel agreement, right? And you have Basel agreement 1, Basel agreement 4. What's the most current one? 3. Right. So Basel agreement is basically a bunch of regulations that banks have to satisfy. And one of these regulations is how much capital banks should have according to this regulation. If a bank has less capital than the regulation prescribes, then they can sue it and they can close it down and the bank will be thrown into disrepute. So it's very, very important for every bank to fulfill this Basel III agreement, right? And of course, the more capital you keep, the less profitable your operations are as a bank, because it means that the less cash you have to invest, right? So you have to create a financial solution for your bank to have enough capital to tick the box in front of the Basel agreement. Now, there's tier one capital, there's tier two capital, and tier three capital. These are the groups of capital assets that have different liquidation value. So the most liquid assets are tier one capital, where the conversion rate is 1-to-1. So if you have every euro of this asset is counts as every euro of your capital. There's also tier three capital, such as, I don't know, goodwill or intellectual property, where there's a less advantageous conversion rate. So if you're a bank and you want to have sufficient capital to satisfy the operational requirements, you have to have lots of life insurance policies on your employees, because the balance on the life insurance policies counts as tier one capital. You see what I mean? I think it's a perfect business idea, no? So ethical considerations are very important, and a lot of people much more qualified in ethics than I am have justly raised concerns. As a business proposition, this sounds like a very sensible business idea. Okay, and look. These are the holdings, the life insurance holdings. These observations are a bit dated, but these are the life insurance holdings of the major banking institutions in North America. This time it's Wall Street Journal. So this is specifically for banks. Why? because of the tier one capital, you know, so these guys need to have as little cash as possible as their capital, because they want to invest as much as possible. So they need to create a bunch of assets that they could classify as tier one capital. Life insurance is an excellent solution. Okay, so and also the firms say that, look guys, we live in a world where people live longer and longer and longer, and that means that we are running considerable deficits when it comes to funding the pension, our obligations towards pension income of our previous employees. Because, you know, suppose somebody started working for you 60 years ago and 10 years ago they retired. So in terms of your calculations 60 years ago, this person wouldn't have lived until his actual retirement. So his pension contribution sounded like good business for you, but not anymore. And now you have to pay these pension contributions to a bunch of your former employees, could contribute to their pension funds. It's unsustainable, costs a lot of money. So where do you get this money? Well, you get this money from other sources of income. So firms actually said that they had to finance pension obligations with investments taxed at normal rate. And if they had to do this, they would incur a loss. So they said, if we want to offer the existing benefits to employees, such as pension benefits, we have to fund these benefits through some not very ethically correct decisions that do not make our employees worse off. They're just not very ethical, okay? So let's do that. Now, in reality, so the Office of the Comptroller, it's the highest authority of that takes care of the banks. So banks can buy life insurance to finance employee benefits. It's perfectly legal, it's great, but executive compensation accounts for most of the value of these benefits. So what they do, they buy life insurance on the junior people. When they die, they cash in. And the money that gets earned through these life insurances, a lot of it goes towards executive bonuses. So not a very interesting situation. There are a number of perspectives to this. Two main perspectives, the ethical perspective and the business perspective. From the ethical perspective, of course, it's very questionable. And I think a lot of eyebrows would be raised in Germany if such scheme existed. Does it exist in Germany? No. Right. But as a business proposition, it sounds very reasonable. So, to summarize, the reason why firms do this practice is tax advantages. But are such advantages justified from the welfare point of view? So, if you want to sort of take advantage of the existing tax system that does not charge income tax on insurance payments, you know, either the tax should apply to insurance payments, or such use of the system should be banned. Now, is this abuse of the system from the tax point of view? Is this abuse of the system or not? You could argue that it is actually abuse of the system. Why? Because in principle, you could make more than one life insurance on the death of the same employee. In which case, it will be abuse of the system. Why? Because the tax relief on insurance payment works on the assumption that the person dies only once, and you need to release this insurance payments tax-free only once. Now, if you have 10 life insurances on the same person, it's as if this person dies 10 times. In each of these 10 times, you have to release the tax, the income tax that would have been withheld in the normal way. So from the tax contribution point of view, from the welfare point of view, I think there's a case for at least, you know, a more careful review of these practices. Now, further benefit administration issues. Who should you cover with benefits? How much benefit choice should you have, right? And most important, how do you finance benefit plans, right? So far, let me start with these relatively easy issues. So who should be covered is more or less, you know, policy issue. There's no legal prescription, right? If you cover more, you're more generous. If you cover fewer people, you can offer more money to the people you cover, but of course to the rest you'll be a lot less generous. And it's really a technical issue that I don't think has a lot of interesting strategic implications. How much benefit choice should employees have? That's a more interesting issue. And the trade-off here, as we've already mentioned in the lecture, is benefit choice is clearly beneficial because it allows to maximize the perceived value of the benefits part of the C&B package offered by the firm. Why? Because different people have different valuation of the benefits that they are offered. So, on the one hand, benefit choice is clearly beneficial. On the other hand, greater benefit choice requires more administrative effort, and that, of course, reduces the efficiency, the overall efficiency of the benefit system. Now, let's turn to this very interesting question about how to finance flexible benefits plans. It may appear to an inexperienced student of compensation and benefits that when we talk about benefits, we talk about something that is paid for by the employer entirely and is given to the employee as some sort of gift. That's what happens most of the time, but not all the time. In fact, what happens more and more these days is the so-called defined contribution practice. The defined contribution practice is actually a very clever practice. It's, I would argue, is the best currently available practices of benefit administration. What it does, it says, okay, let us cash the value of the benefits that we give to the average worker in our firm. Let's just do calculations about, you know, let's just have an estimate of how much cash an average employee would prefer in return for the benefits that we offer to them. Okay. And based on this figure, let us price different benefits in terms of this cash. So we say you will have a certain amount of benefits not exceeding, I don't know, 30,000 euros per year in total, or whatever, 2,500 euros per month. And you're free to use this benefit budget the way you like by buying benefits from the following list for the following prices. Now, it may happen that then when there is a menu, of benefits, people might buy less benefits than the value that the budget that they're given, in which case they'll get the cash taxed at the progressive tax rate as part of their salary. Or it may be that employees might actually want more benefits than you are giving them according to the budget, in which case they'll have to buy the additional benefits. Okay? So the additional flexibility of the benefits plans can be financed without extra financial uncertainty as to the costs of the benefits plans by through the principle of defined contribution. So you can have more benefits, you can have less benefits, but the firm limits its benefit liabilities to a particular amount of money that it clearly communicates to its employees. Now, this is just some illustrations about the benefit coverage for, you know, this relates to the who should be covered. Not surprisingly, the full-timers are covered much more than part-timers. That's not very surprising. This is just a picture from the textbook showing the different combinations of a flexible benefits package. Notice that this is not a menu. Sorry. It is a menu. Notice that this is not quite the cafeteria benefits, right? It's a menu. It's a set of menu choices. You know, you can't, for instance, have a combination of A and C. You have to buy either A or C. So it's slightly less flexible variant of the cafeteria plan, but going roughly in the same direction. So here are the advantages and disadvantages of flexible benefits plans. Now, I just gave them for the record. Let me start with advantages. The idea is that actually the advantages of flexible benefits plans are a lot greater than their possible disadvantages. We should take note of the possible disadvantages of flexible benefits plans, but practice shows that advantages are a lot stronger. So, best choice, best correspondence to the unique needs and preferences of employees. This is quite important to improve the value of the benefits plans offered to the workers. And remember, the prize in the game of designing the optimal benefit system is to increase as much as possible the value of the benefits to the workers. So it's not only flexibility in terms of needs of different workers, it's also flexibility in terms of needs of the same worker at different stages of their life cycle. Increased involvement in decision-making about benefits improves the understanding and visibility of the benefits. This was the point I made earlier about cafeteria plan having a psychological benefit of teaching the workers a lot more about the benefits than just a brief note in the job offer letter. Flexible plans make introduction of new benefits less costly because they have the framework established already, so you don't need an additional set of administrative procedures each time you feel like introducing a new benefit. And there is a very important benefit of cost containment. The defined contribution that goes together with flexible benefit plan, it limits the liability of the firm when it comes to benefits to a predefined amount. This is very, very important. Right now, the benefits of the firms... that's interesting. So in Germany, the benefits of the firms are actually limited. The benefit liabilities of the firms are actually limited by a certain amount of money. So think about, for instance, sickness absence. If you're sick for 3 days, up to 3 days, you can just say, I'm sick, and the firm will pay you money, no questions asked. If you're sick more than 3 days, you need to bring a doctor's note. And if you don't bring a doctor's note, you will not get the benefit. If you are sick long term with a doctor's note, then after some point, they will start paying you less and the disability insurance will start paying in, right? So there are administrative mechanisms to limit the liability of firms to cover such benefits for the workers as, for instance, sickness absence. In the United States, in North America, where firms are responsible for pension for managing pensions of their employees, the pension liabilities are theoretically not limited. So you can't say, guys, I'm not paying you more than this total. It doesn't matter that you live longer. I'm just going to limit my pension contributions to this many billion dollars. You will easily get sued as a firm, and that will be problematic. That's why old manufacturing firms like General Motors, for instance, had a huge problem with financing of their pension schemes before they struck a new agreement with the powerful trade union. So putting a limit on the firm's obligations towards funding employees' benefits is an important problem. The defined contribution policies that firms stick to is, of course, a very welcome solution to this problem. Problem, of course, from the firm's point of view, not from the employee's point of view. Now, just for the record, there are a couple of disadvantages. So one disadvantage is that it's administratively quite complicated. I've said several times, doesn't need repeating. There are a couple more interesting issues here. So first, if we offer a very large menu at our benefit cafeteria. So lots and lots of benefits. Lots and lots of benefits. Then, you know, people can make bad choices. One bad choice that people can make is to cash all the benefits into the current income. And this way they will underfund their pension, and in the old age they will have less money at their disposal. So there is an argument in the literature, very well empirically founded literature, that employees themselves will benefit from a gentle nudging towards contributing towards making a better benefits choice. Now, there is also, if you offer flexible benefit plans, there may be issues potentially related to discrimination or non-discrimination. So, let's say you're a firm that offer an additional medical insurance to your employees. A lot of German firms do that. So in Germany, you know how it works. In Germany, you can, if you earn less than X per year, you have the mandatory insurance, the Techniker Krankenkasse, for instance, right? Correct me, I'm not, you know. If you earn more than X per year, you have to have private, you may take private insurance. And in Germany, many people think that private medical insurance gives you a better value because you will be seen by more doctors and the waiting times are shorter, etc. I don't know. As a public servant, I have to take private medical insurance, and actually I'm very annoyed. I would rather not, because I have to pay my medical expenses and then wait for them to be refunded by Hilfe and other. But firms can actually supplement the medical insurance packages to their firms. Okay. What sort of medical services, what sort of coverage would you as a firm include into the medical insurance package? It's a rhetorical question. I'm not, you know, telling you, give me, you know, this and this and this, because it's actually, you need to have quite a lot of expertise there. But it's not a trivial question. The importance of this question goes beyond rhetoric, because people can actually say, you are providing this benefit, but I can't take advantage of this benefit because my physiology does not allow it, for example. Very interesting case was, there's still, last time I read it was about a year ago, in Britain, there was an argument for gender reassignment procedures to be covered under medical insurance, right? So should you or should you not include these procedures in your medical coverage? There are advantages and disadvantages. The advantage, of course, is you give people a broader choice of options. The disadvantage is that very few people will make use of these options, but if you do not offer this option, then you may have to reconsider later on, because there may be someone with a demand which will be supported by some sort of legal decision. So there could be, if you give people a lot of choice of potential benefits, there may be legal requirements that you will have to comply with, which will make this menu of choices more expensive to administer than you would think otherwise. But of course, you know, these issues are actually quite, you know, these are not what happens each and every day. These are not the most frequently occurring events when it comes to the administration of benefits. The most important issue, of course, is the administrative costs. And this disadvantage set against the many advantages of flexible benefits plans, I think logically results in a very strong argument in favor of flexible benefits plans. So I am looking forward to the University of Constance, as well as many other universities in Baden-Württemberg, considering and implementing a cafeteria type benefit plan rather than a fixed benefits choice that they have right now. Having said that, I am very well aware of these benefits and am grateful to my employer for providing them. So that's basically it.